Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida legislature spent a lot of time and trouble setting up a medical marijuana distribution system. Now the courts have kicked that system to the curb.
Good guys with the guns went after the cartels. Now the good guys with the guns protect the cartels as it relates to medical marijuana.
Also this week, it was like something out of a TV show. Perhaps it should have been called CSI Jackson County.
This is something we're not proud of. No agency wants to go through this type of situation and face the embarrassment from the public.
We'll also visit a gender-neutral workforce training session. We'll see the rebirth of an old schoolhouse that was nearly destroyed by a hurricane and go over our critical needs checklist in advance of the next storm that comes calling. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida courts have spoken and say the state's medical marijuana distribution system is unconstitutional. Blaise Ganey reports that could soon force the legislature and the industry to make changes.
In the case of Fluorogrown versus the Florida Department of Health, the First District Court of Appeals said the legislature's rules to get a license conflict with the constitutional amendment, specifically the portion that defines a medical marijuana treatment center.
The amendment said an MMTC would grow, dispense, or process, or educate. The word or means they could do any one of those items. In the law that was promulgated by the state, they said the word and they created a vertical system.
Dr. Mark Moore is a certified medical cannabis physician for MedCan in Tallahassee.
We're at year three. 3 years have gone by, and this was just declared unconstitutional and recognized what all the patients in the public recognized 2.5 years ago, that this was not acceptable.
By requiring treatment centers to also do production and distribution, the state has created a system that favors large businesses. According to the Department of Health, there are only 142 dispensaries in Florida and 22 businesses. Out of those, only 13 are operating and serving 240,000 Floridians.
It's really unheard of. There are no other states that do it that have done it this way. Oregon has thousands of licenses. Colorado has thousands of licenses. California, thousands of licenses.
Dr. Moore wants Florida to make a change to be more like those states. Medical Marijuana Business Association of Florida's executive director, Jeffrey Sharkey, thinks the state will be more hesitant than Moore hopes.
These licenses recently have been sold for anywhere between, you know, $50 and $60 million. So there's a lot of investment that's been made in these existing licenses here. I think it would be, the department would be a little reluctant to step out on their own and say, we think that a reasonable number of decoupled licenses, a license for cultivation, a license for processing, a license for retail distribution, should be X, whatever that number is.
And Sharkey thinks opening the market may not be the right approach.
I watch the national market. The price of a pound of marijuana, adult rec legal, 2 years ago was $4,000 a pound, approximately. It's now $900 a pound because there's so much oversupply. There's so many licenses, so many growers that they're flooding the market with product and people are undercutting.
Sharkey instead thinks the legislature will ultimately get a second shot at fixing the market, a market First DCA Judge Scott Makar calls an oligopoly, while others have a harsher word for it.
They can call it an oligopoly. I'll call it a cartel. I think what the legislature did was set up essentially a state-sanctioned cartel. For decades, almost generations, the good guys with the guns went after the cartels. Now the good guys with the guns protect the cartels as it relates to medical marijuana. Florida needs to end this. We need to open up the market.
That's St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis. For the past 3 years, he's filed legislation to open the medical marijuana market and says he never supported vertical integration.
There's room for probably dozens, if not hundreds, of growers in the state of Florida. There's room for a handful of processors, and there's room for a number of dispensaries.
Brandis believes having more businesses is best for the market and will benefit patients.
All along the line, it was always what was best for the medical marijuana treatment centers. It was not what was best for the patient. What's best for the patient is access.
Brandis says patients who can't afford medical marijuana don't have access to it because their medicine isn't affordable. An ounce in Florida can be up to $400 as opposed to $30 in Oregon. For now, Senator Brandis says he's waiting to hear whether the governor's office will appeal the ruling. If not, he expects this to be the focus when committee weeks start in September. I'm Blaze Ganey.
And as long as we're on the subject of drugs, it sounds like something out of a crime drama. A dirty cop plants illegal drugs on people, then arrests them. State investigators say that's exactly what happened in one North Florida county. And we get that story from Lynn Hatter.
Nearly 120 cases have been dropped and about a dozen lawsuits have been filed against the Jackson County Sheriff's Department. That's where 26-year-old Zachary Wester worked as a deputy until last September when he was fired. Investigators say they spent hundreds of hours looking into Wester after the Jackson County Sheriff requested an independent inquiry. Among the evidence gathered, drugs in Wester's patrol car.
The investigation revealed 42 items of drug paraphernalia, 10 separately packaged quantities of methamphetamine, and 5 separate quantities of marijuana.
The Florida Department of Law Enforcement's Chris Williams says it's logged more than 1,400 hours on the case. Jackson County is in the 14th Judicial District, but the state prosecutor recused himself, and Governor Ron DeSantis moved the case to First District State Attorney Bill Edens, who says he's prepared to go to trial immediately.
The investigation has reached a point where I felt, although it's not complete, and I want to emphasize that, the investigation had reached a point where I felt that it was appropriate because of the nature of the charges and the fact that it was a public employee. I determined that it was appropriate to seek an arrest warrant from a judge and have the defendant arrested.
Wester is facing scores of felony and misdemeanor charges stemming from his arrests of 11 people. The most serious are felony charges of racketeering, which carry a minimum of 13 and a half years in prison. But why did Wester plant drugs on people? And was he targeting anyone?
You're never certain of what lays in the heart of man. We have some ideas and some theories, and we've talked about that a lot, but I do not feel that it would be appropriate to really go into it in any detail at this time.
What he can say is that there won't be any deals. No plea bargains, no reduced charges.
My office has a history of taking a very strong position in matters involving public employees or public officials.
There's no official count on the number of crimes committed by or arrests of law enforcement, so the U.S. Department of Justice commissioned a study. That 2016 report is called Police Integrity Lost. It examined the extent and nature of police crimes in the United States, and it looked into how agencies responded to officers arrested. Researchers at Bowling Green State University looked to news reports of officers arrested between 2005 and 2011, and they found about 2 officer arrests per 100,000 officers nationwide.
It's not that uncommon that police officers get in trouble. Police officers get arrested across the country literally every day of the year across the United States, where a police officer not only gets arrested, but there's an article or more than one article in the local newspapers about the alleged crimes.
Phil Stenson is a former officer and assistant professor of criminal justice at Bowling Green State. He was the lead researcher on that 2016 DOJ study and now runs a database of officer arrests. There's a podcast, too, where he discusses his work. In the era of video, when people are recording and so are officers, Stenson says it's likely more of them will be caught.
With some of these devices, the camera's actually always on, if you will, but it's set up in a way that it records the 30 seconds prior to when the on switch is engaged. So if an officer puts the on switch on, it's going to capture what happened in the seconds immediately before that and keep that part of the recording. And what we're seeing in some of these cases is that officers have been accused of planting evidence in a few instances where they really didn't think that through.
That's what happened in a similar case in Baltimore last year. Florida investigators say Jackson County's ex-deputy Wester manipulated his body camera to hide what he was doing. There are more than a million sworn law enforcement officers in the country, and the number of those arrested for crimes is relatively low. But each time it happens, State Attorney Eddins says it cuts to the heart of the criminal justice system. A 2018 Gallup poll shows law enforcement is one of the most trusted institutions in the country, but faith in the criminal justice system isn't. And Florida Department of Law Enforcement's Chris Williams, speaking by phone, says Wester's actions are another blow to public confidence.
He clearly violated his oath of office, and as a result of that, people lost their liberty based on his crimes.
This is something we're not proud of. No agency wants to go through this type of situation and face the embarrassment from the public.
That's Jackson County Sheriff Lou Roberts. Police crimes have real-world consequences. An arrest, even without a charge, is still a record, and mugshots can live online in perpetuity. In Wester's case, at least one of his alleged crimes cost a man custody of his daughter. I'm Len Hatter.
And we should add that Wester's bail has been set at just under $170,000. Still to come on Capitol Report, local groups want to show that workforce training knows no gender bias.
95% of the folks that we just did a hand survey with had never ever been inside the manufacturing center. So this is a first time.
And when's the best time to shoot a great home video? How about before the next hurricane hits?
One way is to walk through, take pictures, or create a video and then store that, maybe even send a copy to your insurance agent once in a while.
A new study describes the future mass redistribution of plants and animals on Earth due to climate change. An author of the study says Florida is already experiencing this migration due to global warming. Brett Schiffers is a professor of wildlife ecology at the University of Florida, and he spoke with WUSF's Jessica Mazaros.
What is climate change doing in terms of migrating animals?
Well, so every species occurs in a place because it has a climate that it prefers, it has resources that it prefers. And with climate change, plants are responding to the increasing temperatures or changes in rainfall. And if plants move and habitats move, then animals move as well. So basically what we're going to see is, you, me, our neighbors are going to basically in the future, we're going to experience a lot of events like extreme weather events here in Florida. It'd be hurricanes or droughts. And at the same time, we're also going to see kind of the arrival of and the departure of species in response to changing climates.
And what caused you to highlight this? Why should people care?
The way we think about species is really like our fondness for species occurs along a gradient from good to bad, right? I mean, so there are good species. These could be species that we think are beautiful. It could be species that have recreational value. And let's say fish species or animals that we hunt or bird watching, et cetera. So there's lots of recreational activities and reasons we value species. But there's also the bad species, right? So these could be pests, agricultural pests, or even diseases. And so as these different plants and animals respond to climate change, they're going to have costs. They're going to have benefits and costs to society. And that's something that we should take quite seriously. It basically means that we have a high level of uncertainty in our futures.
What do we think about Florida in terms of climate change and the animals here?
Florida it's a unique place geographically. It's a very diverse state in the U.S. It spans from the tropics to subtropical to kind of temperate, and it has a large marine area, so it has a large seascape and a large landscape. Relative to the other states in the U.S., we're kind of, we're ground zero for climate change impacts. We have one of the largest shorelines of any state, so sea level rise is going to cause issues for coastal communities. But it also, because it kind of has that tropical to temperate gradient, we're going to probably see a lot of tropical species moving into our temperate waters. So, for example, in marine systems, you have the common snook, which is a fish that's usually found in tropical waters. It's now moving up into the northern Gulf area. Some people might say that's good. Some people might say it's bad. It's good maybe because it's a recreational species. It's bad because it's a predatory fish that might eat a lot of other species that have been here in the past. It might create some management issues there. We also will see, and we have been seeing, the encroachment of mangroves from the south into salt marshes in more temperate regions. And so that could create some conflict as well as mangroves take over kind of these habitats that we identify with from our childhoods and now. So there's going to be a lot of changing, and it's going to require, you know, some people will see it good and some people will see it bad.
Brett Sheffers, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it, and thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me.
The study by UF and the University of Tasmania appears in the journal Nature Climate Change. Last month, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill aimed at promoting workforce training for students and adults. Recently, Tallahassee Community College's Manufacturing Center hosted a ladies' night to ensure women know those opportunities are open for them, too. Regan McCarthy has more.
No, the machine's not going to run while it's open. It's pretty safe. You have to have the door closed.
A group of women and girls are gathered around what's called a CNC mill. They peer through a plexiglass window as a machine cuts shapes into a small metal slab.
Don't let it intimidate you. It can make noise. I mean, it is metal on metal, so.
Jermaine Dickey is a machinist instructor at Tallahassee Community College. He's demonstrating the mill on this day and says coming into a workshop for the first time can be intimidating for anyone.
I think no matter who you are, if you're in a machine shop, these machines are very powerful and you can get hurt very easily. So I think anybody would be intimidated. I'm still intimidated by the lathe when it cuts on and that machine when it cuts on because it's very powerful. You can feel it. So
that's why TCC is hosting a ladies' night. Kimberly Moore is the college's vice president for workforce innovation. She says women make up less than 25% of the workforce for jobs like manufacturing, machining, and welding. And she says one reason for that is myths.
Myths that those jobs may be ones that we've thought about in the past that are dirty and not clean and, you know, you don't want to get, it's not, because honestly what's happened with the evolution and the infusion of technology, a lot of it has been automated. So any bad thoughts of what they may have had about those professions no longer exist.
Moore says the goal is to make sure women know these jobs are an option for them.
95% of the folks that we just did a hand survey with had never, ever been inside the manufacturing center. So this is the first time there are groups of girls that are here, like with the city of Tallahassee. Their program is here, as well as a number of other community-based groups and just individuals where they're wanting to learn more and they're bringing their daughters with them.
That's why Kimberly Williams is attending the event.
Just to know about the different jobs and the opportunities available that they have out for females. I have nieces and a 13-year-old daughter, so I can get the information and relay it back to them.
She says when she was growing up, there weren't as many opportunities available for women. But she says that's changed, and she wants to make sure her daughter knows that.
You females, it's like women power. They can do anything that a man can do. And this type of, and it's basically a lot of them don't know, because with the older generation, they that's something that they didn't want, or they just didn't know that women can go into, like architecture, construction, welding, mechanic, auto mechanic.
TCC's push to introduce more women to these fields coincides with an increased focus from state leaders like Governor Ron DeSantis on helping young people explore workforce training as a route to a future career. Moore says she hopes that will mean more opportunities for young women to see the full range of job opportunities available to them. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Hurricane Michael almost destroyed a century-old piece of history when it hit Callaway, Florida. Now the city must dismantle and piece back its one-room schoolhouse to save its historical value. Robbie Gaffney reports.
Some of the best minds that we have produced in this country was produced in one-room schoolhouses.
91-year-old Lillian Patterson lives in Callaway, Florida. Down the road from her is a 108-year-old schoolhouse. Callaway is one of many small cities in the Big Bend.
Like Abraham Lincoln and a lot of other people that have been high in government had very little formal education. Now this schoolhouse only went to the, I guess, eighth grade.
One-room schoolhouse structures built centuries ago rarely act as schools anymore. The structures are mostly museums now, and there are not many left in Florida. Hurricane Michael nearly destroyed the one in Callaway. Patterson stayed in the city, even as others left.
Just about everybody lost a roof.
And after the storm passed, the city's leisure services director, Tim Laguerre, went to the schoolhouse.
It was worse than I could have imagined.
Winds blew the building off its foundation, a brick crashed through the roof, window glass shattered along the floorboards, and the front steps are so warped, they're not safe to walk on.
You get up and you go look around and you don't know where to start when you see something like that.
Some of the old school desks and photos were rescued, but other items like the piano are smashed beyond repair.
We're going to try to salvage everything that is salvageable.
Chris Hawk is the project manager for Synergy NDS, an emergency response and recovery team that's supporting the city of Callaway. The schoolhouse will need to be deconstructed in order to be rebuilt. It'll have to be taken down piece by piece. Replacement parts have to match the originals. And that's a bit of a challenge on a century-old building.
If we can't come up with reclaimed, oak flooring to match, it can be a composite and made to match.
Composites can be new lumber made to look old. Hawk says the school's restoration will be a long process, but Callaway locals like John Piercy say it's worth it.
You think about all the things they did, like the jump rope, the playing the ball, kicking the ball. You can look at the old school and your mind can just wonder, and you can just imagine how it went when they were going to school back then. And it gets close to me.
I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Despite recent showers, the threat for wildfires continue in Florida. Research out of the University of Florida shows the dry season in the southeastern United States is lasting longer, raising the risk of lightning-ignited fire. Kevin Del Orbe has that.
In collaboration with North Carolina State University, UF researcher Jennifer Phil and her team found that in some parts of the southeast region of the United States, dry season has seen a 130% increase over 120 years.
The length of that dry period that we're used to typically experiencing, as I said, around, October, November until, roughly May, June, July, that's become a lot longer.
Phil says Florida has seen a considerably longer dry season.
72, so roughly 72 days, which is about a little more than two months. So the dry season has become a little more than 2 months longer than it was.
Phil and her team looked at thunderstorm activity to see if there's a potential for lightning-ignited fires. The researchers found that the overlap between dry season and thunderstorms are increasing over time, potentially increasing fire risks.
If you have drier fuels, drier fuels are more likely to ignite. I think one of the interesting questions that, for me, that's arisen out of this is what it means in terms of intentional human ignitions.
Prescribed burns are a method forest managers use to control the risk of wildfire. But with all the downed timber from Hurricane Michael and a longer dry season, Phil believes forest managers may have a tougher time planning prescribed burns in the areas with high risk. I'm Kem DeLorbe.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Although the storm called Barry ultimately veered away from Florida's Gulf Coast, the close call to the region, battered so mercilessly by last year's Hurricane Michael, had more than a few residents diving back into storm preparation mode. By now, just about everyone can recite the basics nearly by heart, have a week's worth of food and water available, fill up the gas tank before the storm arrives, all that. But there are some other less obvious preparations that are easy to miss when danger threatens. So we spoke with a real expert in this area. He's Ben Graybar, a commercial banker at Hancock Whitney Bank. That Gulf Coast financial institution is very familiar with storm resilience when it comes to its own operations and the general public. Graybar says there is one simple rule of thumb to keep in mind.
Think of it like this. Anything that if you had to get up and leave your house and you weren't ever allowed to come back, what would you need to have a copy of or a picture of, some sort of documentation of? Those are the things that you want to maybe pay attention right now to where they are.
What kinds of items might fit into that category?
Everything from copies of car titles, copies of insurance cards, maybe even just copies of your checking account number, of your credit cards themselves, and then any of those keepsake items that you think are of higher value that if they disappeared, you would want to have evidence of what they were for insurance reasons.
Graybar says the video documentation process is about as simple as things get.
You can actually just take your cell phone and take a tour of your household inside and out, make a video of it, and then you can download that privately on YouTube, which is affiliated with the Google Gmail folks, and then you have a record of that that you can share with your insurance agent.
But as marvelous as our phones and the networks they're connected to are, a truly catastrophic storm can quickly return us to a time before the internet and even before electricity. Most cell phone sites start winking out within 48 hours of losing commercial power, and most cell phones will be depleted long before that. Any business still functioning may be cash only if it's unable to process debit or credit card transactions, so Graybar suggests having a cash stash.
How much cash is the right amount of cash to have? For some people, that's a bigger number than others. But you certainly want to be able to sustain and or transport yourself from harm's way for at least a few days, if not for longer, is better. But again, where is that cash going to be stored? If harm is coming your way, you don't want to put that someplace where it is able to be affected by whatever is going on. So make sure it's in as safe of a place, potentially on your person, as that storm is taking place.
One more thing. As important as documents and physical possessions may be, nothing is more important than the people you care about and who care about you. Because anyone who's lived through a disaster will tell you there are few words as terrifying as, we don't know where they are or if they're okay.
You need to be able to communicate with everyone in your family. Where do we go if it gets really bad? What spot in the house? Where do we go? So we all know we're in the same spot. And then you have to have an outside of your family communications piece that might involve family, it might involve your coworkers, so that everyone knows how and where you're going to check in, so that there's a central known place and people aren't worrying about, oh, is anyone reached Ben? Do we know where to find him? Because I've already communicated with my check-in person, and we don't have to have 15 people trying to check with the same person and using up that precious battery life on my phone.
It all seems like reasonable common sense, but by the time the winds howl and the storm surge comes roaring in, reason and common sense can be very hard to come by. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Robbie Gaffney and Kevin Del Orbe. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.